All right, welcome to Inside Independent Publishing with IBPA. I'm your host, Christopher Locke. I'm also the IBPA Director of Membership and Member Services. Okay, so for all the independent publishers out there, what would you say if we told you that your publishing distribution could be more profitable, sustainable, and eco-friendly? I'm assuming that all of y'all are like, that's amazing. Well, IBPA is always looking for ways to set up independent publishers for success. So we partner with PubWest and Portland State University's graduate program in book publishing to research five key issues facing publishing distribution today. So, to discuss the findings of that project, we've invited Portland State University's Director of Book Publishing and Assistant Professor in English, Dr. Rachel Norda, and Rachel Doan, who is one of the talented students who worked on this project and a freelance publishing professional. Hello to both of you.
Hey, hi. Hi, Christopher.
All right. Hello. Well, first off, I'm excited that we are going to solve all the problems of publishing distribution once and for all in this one podcast. So thank you for doing that. And by the way, I hope I'm not overselling. That's what I'm putting in the description. So we better live up to it.
No pressure. None.
Okay. So y'all, there were kind of five main questions that y'all focused on. So that's how I want to split this up. And we'll just discuss each one and we'll go one by one. So let's start with, this is the first question. What does efficient and cost-effective delivery of print books to readers look like going forward? So if you all want to, I have questions underneath that, but you're welcome to just jump in and be like, here's all the solutions. So go for it.
Well, I think that depends a little bit about how sustainable you want that to be, but also how accessible and timely on your side too as a distributor. I think some of the things we discovered during looking at this is that one of the reasons why we're having such a big distribution chain problem is we're relying on overseas printing. And that's because the infrastructure of the US printing has just kind of decayed over the last couple of decades. And that's for, as we go into the paper, for a multitude of reasons, but there are some ways to remedy that, including reinvesting into our infrastructure, reinvesting into our publishing employees, but as well as also reinfrastructuring into our actual ecosystem of trees and whatnot, and actually how we print in general. And that's, I would say, a very broad paintbrush stroke of like what the future looks like.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting in the report about this whole outsourcing thing. And I was wondering, like, is that possible to bring it all back to the U.S.? Because some things that you all, like, mentioned in the report are things like that, and it seems specifically Asia seems to be the place where a lot of the printing happens. It was like, oh, the printers there are better or whatever. And I'm like, well, why can't we just get those same printers in the U.S.? Like, what's going on? Do they just make them there and they can't put them here? Like, how do we get that back to the U.S., all that production?
Yeah, you've got to start somewhere, and we've got to start where we are and build from there. But in the end, it's going to be better for publishers if the printing can particularly be in the U.S. Because many publishers have experienced really long wait times and shipping times and all of those things because of supply chain issues happening around COVID. And so it's not just, oh, that would be a nice thing to do. Yeah, we should be more local. But actually, this would really help all of us to be able to get books to readers in a timely manner and when we say we're going to. Delivery of books is a tricky thing. One of the things that we do talk about in the report for a couple of things, but for delivery too, is the power of trade organizations. And so, you know, IBPA being one of those, PubWest another that we partnered with, but there are many even for booksellers like the American Booksellers Association. And there might be the possibility of bringing printing to the US, of getting better deals with booksellers and with printers if we're as a collective rather than a bunch of individual independent presses.
And that also is a bigger conversation too about legislation too, because as we saw, like with the Clinton, we don't go into this part, but in the Clinton era, a lot of our industry went out, right? And so now we're kind of looking at maybe bringing stuff back in as a country as a whole, right? And I think printing, as we've seen with the paper shortages across the whole industries, not just publishing, but also manufacturing and industry goods, that that's just become a bigger question now and a bigger problem to solve. But there are publishers in the US, at least in the Americas, that can print these high color graphic books that you're talking about, Chris, that are, is it Chris or Christopher?
Either one, but okay. Christopher's fine. Whatever you want. We're okay. All friends. Oh, and this is Rachel Doan talking, so people recognize the voice, by the way.
Yes. But there are printers, like one of the ones that we found actually works with Patagonia, and they make beautiful books. Mm-hmm. There's no problem in them making these beautiful books. It's just that they're one printer out of a dozen that does this work. And it's just, again, another question of reinvesting that money back into rebuilding the structure of our presses overall.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I wanted to talk, one of the solutions under this like cost-effective delivery of print books you all mentioned is pre-orders, and that mm-hmm. can help reduce costs. So can you just kind of explain why pre-orders are so important to reduce costs?
Well, many publishers, independent publishers, work direct to consumer, or at least have some sort of presence there, and especially during COVID, because otherwise you have to rely on, you know, some of the organizations we don't love, like Amazon. And so that direct to consumer means you also have data about your consumers, you know what they're buying, but you can also get them on your email list and all of those things that help to stay connected with the consumer and know what they want. Pre-orders are something suggested in the report because it can be fulfilled directly to consumer, but also it can give something additional in value to consumers to be able to have it early, to maybe have, you know, additional collateral and pieces with it. And it makes it easier for publishers because everyone is having to extend their publication dates at this point and raise their prices because of, shipping delays and all of those things and print costs. So being able to have pre-orders that you know are going to come, you know, early helps you also to be more effective in your printing and not be printing and then warehousing all of these books that you don't need.
Yeah, and that also builds onto, and I mean, most of IBPA, when we talk to them, like, have ranted about this in some form or another, but the print now, sell more, you know, and return later model that we've had since the World War II era, it's just outdated at this point. It's not necessary, and it produced much more waste than is actually, again, more than necessary. And that also adds for the longer time where we're waiting for our books to come to us because we have these bigger orders that need to be fulfilled. And so if we actually adopt more, you know, commerce practices that are more modern and that actually account for how the market is now, then that makes more sense to do anyway.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about print on demand. There's a whole section about that. And that's one of those things you're discussing. Before that though, I wanted to ask another solution is you mentioned is local and discounted delivery. And this is something I hadn't really heard or as much about. So maybe you can talk about like what are ways that indie publishers can create like local and discounted delivery?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of bookstores have been exploring this during COVID, particularly curbside pickup. And we're here in Portland, Rachel Doan and I, and, you know, even booksellers, but also some publishers like Microcosm delivering books on their bikes, which makes sense for a Portland vibe. But the idea that there's some sort of value or incentive from buying local because Amazon can usually beat on price. And so many people have Amazon Prime subscriptions that, you know, delivery as well can be very fast and cheap. And so what value are you adding to the customer, you know, whether you're an independent publisher or an independent bookseller, to have them buy specifically from you? I think that's what everyone should be thinking about.
Mm. And booksellers should really focus on this, but even indie publishers, like, are you suggesting like they, like, rather than, you know, like they have their own, what, e-commerce store or something, and then they find a way to get it directly to readers as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of some of the publishers here that have, or ones that I've seen, you know, outside of Portland too that have warehouse sales. So, you know, kind of make an event around selling some books, particularly from, you know, them, not necessarily in collaboration with a bookstore. This is when you can really think about your direct to consumer too. And yeah, what does your website look like? How effective are you in selling there?
Did you want to add anything, Rachel, Doan?
Oh, I was just going to say, I was just going to agree exactly with what Dr. Norton said, but also, I think if you want to compete against Amazon too, in terms of that price button, your best bet is actually having your own website where customers can purchase instead of not having any options at all. Because then you're just not really leaving them an option, but to either go through a bookstore or Amazon at the end of the day.
Okay, great. So I want to switch to another great question that you all were trying to research. Okay, so here's the question. How can the book industry decrease the return rate for books sold into trade channels? Currently, it's an average of 30%, and we are talking about maybe making an average of like 15%. I have a lot of opinions about this, but I want to give you all an opportunity. So what are some of the ways that we can decrease this return rate?
The main way that is talked about in the report is better marketing. So this is another antiquated system, as Rachel was talking earlier about antiquated systems from World War II. Returns is much a part of that, where you know, it just puts a lot of risk on the publisher, as all of you independent publishers know. And so it's hard because bookstores can over order, and then it causes cash flow problems because you think you have all of these books out of the door and then they come back months later. And so it's like selling a book but not really selling. So you know, one of the things that can help with that is to make sure that the marketing of your book, you know, and that's including cover design and all of those things, but also the marketing to the bookstore, accurately shows what the book is. Because we've probably all had the experience as readers where you pick up a book thinking maybe it's one thing from the cover or from the back jacket copy, and then, you know, get into it and realize, oh, this isn't actually my thing, or this is, you know, a different genre than I thought. And so we don't want that experience for booksellers who are then making a bulk order. And so the better we can get at marketing books, that's one way that can really help with the returns problem.
And then, yeah, retiring that buy, sell later model as well, like we just hinted about earlier, is a big problem as well. If we don't, I mean, it's a question of if you print too much and then you have to return it, or if you print the right number, then you don't have to return it. You know, it would be more profitable to have people request more books to be printed than to have to return all the books, essentially.
Yeah. And so you will hit on this some, but this is kind of the big issue I have with this. And this is not necessarily IBPA stance, but I'm standing up for indie publishers. So, I don't love it that so much of this return policy falls, like you were saying, to the publisher. Especially if it's the bookseller, and I love booksellers, but especially if they overorder books, which is on them, that then they don't sell all of them, and then the indie publisher, it's like bankrupt some publishers, where they're like 1,000 books. That's a lot of like returns. So I'm just wondering, like, what can be done to get booksellers to like really try to buy the right amount of books rather than having like this like overstock that then they don't have an incentive to doesn't hurt them. So then, you know, it's then on the publisher. How can we work as indie publishers better with bookstores to kind of get that to even out more?
Oh, that's the great question, isn't it? I mean, I have some thoughts, but none of them are going to like completely solve this problem. But obviously, better relationships with the booksellers as an indie publisher will be helpful because you can have more of that open communication. The more that booksellers can know who their local customers are, the better too, because then they're not just ordering, oh, this is a big book, or, oh, yeah, I think this sounds interesting, but actually, what do your customers want? Because regardless of how much they like the book, if they, you know, order something that customers aren't interested in, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it won an award. It doesn't you know, they need to actually be sold and off the shelf. It's a tricky one, though.
you need to solve everything. I thought we were solving everything.
I thought so, that's too, fine. But, you know, it's a start.
Yeah, but I think this is also, too, one of the parts that I researched was we had an interview, my team and I, we interviewed Carla Olson at Patagonia. And I think this goes back and ties into that marketing bit. If we released galleys or arts to booksellers, right, and we're like, hey, here's our book coming out, you get to know exactly what's in it so you can market the best if this book is interesting for your store or your customer base, right? Then just like Dr. Norda pointed out, booksellers would know exactly what kind of book they're getting into, and then therefore they'd be able to sell it better as well, and they'd be able to order better. So I think there's also a lens of transparency that needs to happen, both that's not been happening, both between the bookseller and the publisher.
Yeah, and you all mentioned an example in the report that I thought was really interesting. So it was about a publisher who there were like certain amount of pre-orders, and they actually would have been penalized if they didn't order like enough books, which I hadn't heard of that concept of, like, you know, like that, like a bookstore would penalize them. Like, we expect, you know, to have a certain amount of like books available to us. So can you, like, what is that? What is that penalty if you don't like order enough based on what the bookstore is like expecting?
It does vary depending on bookstore, but that's also why there's examples like that one and others kind of peppered throughout the report. It's not necessarily a, you know, this is what everything is like to you, but hey, here's a picture of what this could look like or the kinds of things that you may face. I think, you know, to your point, Christopher, that I mean, all of the risk is on the publishers currently. And I would love to see in some, you know, future of publishing where that could be shared between booksellers and publishers a little bit more. You know, whether that's in regards to pre-orders or other things, because then I think there won't be as much of the over-ordering problem too from booksellers, because it, you know, it'll be more risk for them.
Yeah, and go ahead, Rachel.
Oh no, if we're talking about, I lost my train of thought. If I think about it, we'll go back to it.
Actually, it was going to be the solution. And we were this close. We were this close. Yeah. So I thought you all brought up a really interesting idea about returns in the report. Okay. So one solution you had was that debut authors' books could be returnable, but authors with a proven track record could be maybe non-returnable. So like there, that's an interesting solution where, you know, with booksellers, like they have a better chance of not, because I totally get bookstores not wanting to give a chance to something they're like worried about not selling. And so the returnability makes them go, okay, I'll give this book a shot. But if it's like an author that, you know, they know is going to sell well, like, you know, I, like you were saying, I love it to be a little more like even with the two. So I was like, oh, well, that's like, seems like something that's like a compromise. But what do we talk to, like the ABA? Like, who do we like talk to as indie publishers to be like, what about this? What about this, y'all?
You know, that's where I think the trade organization power comes in again, is, you know, IBPA and PubWest and others, like as collectives of publishers, advocating and talking to ABA, you know, and other organizations to make those negotiations, to have those talks. Because when it's just one independent publisher with one independent bookstore, you know, that's okay, but it's not going to have the same power and the same impact on industry protocol and standards as if we can, you know, do this as a team together. I'm glad that you brought up the advice and example of the, you know, debut author versus a longstanding author. It, especially from what we have seen in the last few years about backlist sales, like, you know, that could be a way for publishers to be able to, you know, sell those backlist titles, but not have the same amount of risk with returns as with new authors.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, we'll talk about print on demand. So one thing I thought was that I've heard publishers deal with is that some bookstores don't want to carry a book that's print on demand. Like they think that the quality's not as good. And they've had publishers, like I've had publishers say, they once they found out it was print on demand, they didn't want it. And they're like, what? So I don't know if y'all have heard that like bookstores, like they only want the offset, you know, printing, but that's like a hindrance. Cause God,
I've seen, and this is like not in this paper, but I've seen on TikTok, like, you know, people show differently, like they'll hold the book up and they'll flop it around and they'll show different qualities between printers and stuff like that. So there is, I have seen there is sometimes a difference between print on demand and an offset printer. But I think then the question becomes, again, I would push back and be like, okay, if this is not what you want, but this is the way that books are going to get printed and you're going to get books on time, then, and you don't like this quality, then we need to reinvest back in our infrastructure, first of all. And that's going to take time. But also, I think there's always just this pushback against like the nouveau riche or like, you know, like just anything that's very going to become the new standard or it's a new thing that makes it more affordable. I feel like there's always been some kind of pushback, no matter what kind of history you're looking at or industry. So at that point, I'd be like, well, if they didn't know and they were still selling it before and it was doing good, then why can't they keep selling it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. It's like with when TV came out and the film studios are like, no, TV's terrible. We don't want to. But they're like, oh, wait, you can make money. You can like have your movies play on TV or whatever. Okay, so that brings us to the print on demand. Here's the question that y'all were like researching. What is stopping the industry from embracing print on demand, which is also called POD, as the preferred means for printing non-illustrated black and white trade books? So maybe we can go through some of the quote unquote flaws that people either perceive as being problems with print on demand or actually are problems. You know, I have the list, but you know, you're welcome to, what are some of the flaws that y'all, you know, that are out there?
Well, yeah. And thinking about this topic more broadly, I think the stigma is really the thing that we have to fight. Rachel was talking about that before, but some of the areas that, you know, publishers mention being worried about, like, especially if they're printing full color, you know, worried about binding differences or some of those things. It's not always true, but there is this perception. And from booksellers as well, as you had mentioned, I think that stigma is the thing that we really need to fight, because print on demand has sometimes in the past been used to differentiate between self-published authors and independent publishers. And I don't think that's a very good measure for distinguishing between those two. I mean, I understand why, you know, booksellers, for example, get a lot of independent authors who want to sell, you know, directly through them. And so it's in trying to find, okay, who is a more established publisher or not, but print on demand really isn't a good way to do that. So breaking that stigma is the first step.
Yeah. I would also say that some of the things that is an important to note, and I think that this is the same though also for a traditional publisher, it just sometimes is more apparent with POD, is that you have to have that sweet spot between what you order and not, and it being more expensive. Sometimes if you order too small of a run, it'll get much more inflation cost for price per book than if you ordered X amount of books, it actually would lower the cost per book. So overall, I think that's a problem that you have with offset printers anyway, but more people complain about it with POD than I think than they traditionally see with offset printers, because it's more transparent. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And since Rachel's talking about price there, that is a concern with print on demand. It doesn't scale the same way that offset does. So if you are printing 10,000 copies or going to sell, you know, 10,000 copies, then sometimes it is hard to justify the print on demand. But that's why I think this is especially a good option for the target audience of this report, which is independent publishers, publishers who don't necessarily typically have print runs of 10,000, but are looking more at like a couple of thousand, and what that can mean to not have to warehouse all of those books in the same way, because that's also a cost to consider. So some of the publishers that were interviewed to get some more insights about print on demand, you know, they talked about the higher cost for print on demand and that it's harder to scale. They don't have as many options with the production. But I was at the Pub West conference a couple of months ago, and printers are already talking about limiting options anyway, you know, as we're thinking about bringing things more to the US and just being able to have the right papers and options in stock. So that might be the way that the industry goes anyway, is having fewer options. So, you know, but already publishers are using print on demand just more for set things, things like galleys, advanced readers copies, because it can be very speedy and you can do short, you know, short runs, short amount.
So in terms of, I wanted to get to the next question. Here's the question. What chinks in the book industry's armor were most exposed during the pandemic? So we already talked about that, the whole outsourcing issue. But I wanted to go into another one that I thought was interesting, is that idea of ebooks. So ebooks is something that when it came out, like, everyone was like, uh-oh, goodbye paperback books. And of course, it's more environmentally friendly to have ebooks versus paper books. But ebooks didn't just destroy paper books. I mean, in fact, I think they've kind of dipped a bit and people are still buying paperback. So, I mean, do you think that, like, we should be trying to get readers to get more ebooks? I mean, is this like something that, like, cause, you know, because of the supply chain issues and all that, like, is that something that's like really should be pushed more, or it's just that's what readers want and we just have to kind of be like, well, we got to give them what they want?
I feel like that's a couple of pronged answer. And if answered incorrectly, it might be like devil may care, just buy, you know, ebooks all the time. But one, readers aren't wanting ebooks all the time. We've seen, especially with the pandemic, they want print books. It's actually easier for us to read print books. And if we're interfacing with technology all the time, and I don't know if that's going to necessarily go away, if not increase over time, right? People want to, when they're reading for pleasure, right, they want to read usually a physical book. And there's also the question of pirating as well, which I think Dr. Norda can actually answer very well due to her other research. But and ebooks also, too, if we're thinking, oh, yes, they're going to be easier, too, because of climate and green sustainability. That's not necessarily true either. The making of ebooks is not completely carbon neutral as is anyway. Pushing that all aside, right? I think in terms of going further and in trying to like solve our distribution problems, and I think this is something that we've talked actually a lot, especially among my cohort of people from Ooligan Press, is that I think the future of book publishing that I would like to see is combination books. So when you buy a book, you also get an ebook title at the same time. And so they're sold together. And so if, for instance, the book doesn't arrive on time, the physical book, readers can still read the ebook and it all becomes part of one package deal and one ecosystem. And in that note too, a lot of readers who actually enjoy ebooks, right, and they really love that one book, research says that they will go out and buy that book physically and they'll have a copy in their home. So it's not a pick one and choose the other kind of thing. It's usually actually an ecosystem that we've seen that goes round where they'll buy the print book to have the ebook eventually because they want to read it wherever they want if they really love the book, or they'll buy the ebook and they want the print book eventually. So it would be better, especially with all these distribution problems and these delays of the actual physical book, just to combine the sales altogether.
Yeah, I agree with that. The words that were coming to my mind as Rachel was talking were flexibility, diversifying, and a holistic view of things. I think those are three, you know, not specific to ebooks, but the ebooks are part of this. So, you know, as independent publishers work to be flexible and to diversify their offerings, that means being able to offer various formats, but not, you know, put all of your eggs in one basket, whether that's with print or with ebooks. To have options. And Rachel mentioned the other research project that I've been on this podcast to talk about before, but we're currently in our second round of it, looking at Gen Z and millennials. And it has been really interesting to see how much they like print, Gen Z and millennial readers, and how much, crossover there is in terms of, you know, buying a book that you already have, but in a different format, because you want to be able to read it on the plane in ebook format and not carry the print book in your suitcase or other things like that.
Yeah. And so one other big thing that you all mentioned that's under this concept of the pandemic issues is this like worker shortage. And I thought it was good that you all mentioned in the report is that people are like, oh, what happened to all the people? And actually, it's not that there aren't enough people. The publishing industry is notorious for not paying people very well. And so I wanted to see if you could talk about that. You know, let's give people better pay so they can afford to survive.
Yeah. As someone who is graduating soon from Ooligan Press and going into, you know, the bigger wide world, so to speak, I can tell you from firsthand experience of poring over lots and lots and lots of job searches in many different fields for many different sized companies. It's depressing. Like, it's a little depressing to look at, be like, wow, I did all this effort and all this work. And not to say that Ooligan Press isn't great. It is fun. It's just fantastic. But still being like, wow, I know how much work goes into this. And I know also, too, how often people in the publishing industry work overtime and on weekends and stuff. And this is still the pay that, you know, we're getting. And yeah, I mean, I have lots of feelings about it. But yes, overall, people need to have higher wages, especially too, if we're wanting to diversify the industry. Part of my research that I'm doing actually right now is for people with disabilities actually breaking into the publishing industry and what has kept them out as employees. And one of the bigger costs, one of the bigger things for them is cost, right? They can't afford to work part-time with no benefits for X amount of time or full-time and live in New York and make this much X amount of money and so on and so forth. So I can go on like for a long time about this, and I know we don't have that kind of time. But yes, overall, we definitely need more money to keep people in the industry and not migrate to things like tech or anything else where a lot of our skills are very applicable.
So pay Rachel more money. That's what we got out of this.
Yeah, I actually had a conversation with a publisher here in Portland just recently where they you know, we're sharing a job opening and I said, oh, this is great. I'll share it. But the pay is really low. you know, and we kind of had this back and forth and what they came back with, which I think is what a lot of independent publishers feel is like, we can't pay more than that. You know, the margins are so low. And so I think this issue has many pieces that need to change for there to be real change. And one of those is we need better margins in book publishing. So maybe that means, you know, publishers are raising prices right now anyway because of, you know, supply chain. Maybe we think more about the economic value of a book and what consumers should be paying for books. You know, maybe we think about other things that we can make more efficient or cut out so that we can pay the employees that are there, you know, what they should be paid. As Rachel was saying, yeah, it's really important, especially to help our industry become, you know, less white and more open to LGBTQ community and people with disabilities.
Yeah. And on that note, just, you know, I don't know if it's playing devil's advocate, but I do agree that there are a lot of really great, especially indie publishers who absolutely would like to, you know, have more staff and they would like to pay people great wages, great benefits. But like you said, yeah, the book business, especially in like indie publishing, is not that lucrative. And so like we got to find ways that, yeah, like indie publishers can afford to follow their heart and pay people more money. Because I do talk to a lot of publishers and I think they're incredible, wonderful people that are like, I'd pay people all kinds of money, but I myself, I'm the only employee. That's what they say. I'm the only employee because I cannot afford to have staff. And they're like, I want to have staff, but then it comes with benefits and all these things that they cannot afford, or they would go out of business.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to the question, and I might be plugging into a future question you have, but one of the things we found in our research, again, and this is if we invest in our infrastructure overall, right? It costs way less energy to produce a green book than it actually does a traditional book that we've been doing for the past, I don't know, 80 plus years, right? Or 100 years since World War II. It actually costs a lot less energy, and we have the technology to do so. So that's one way that we can greatly save our costs too, is again, this whole distribution problem of overseas, and then we're not using green resources. And then, like Dr. Norda was saying, we're not pricing our books correctly. And, you know, so it, like Dr. Norda was saying, it's this whole multifaceted problem. But if we were to potentially start solving some of these problems, maybe one at a time or multi-force, then maybe we could actually then have bigger margins overall as well.
If I could add one thing too, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, trade organizations, again, including IBPA, I think are really important in this. So one example is I know PubWest has recently pulled together, you know, some fundraising and money for publishers, independent publishers who want to pay interns, because that's an important piece, but can't because, you know, independent publishing, can apply and draw from these resources so that the intern is getting paid, but also the publisher isn't necessarily, you know, the independent publisher isn't the one who's having to do that out of pocket. So I think more initiatives like that, again, as a collective and as part of an organization, will all help to be useful to the workforce, you know, to those who are entering the industry, but also to the indie publishers.
Yeah. I mean, if we can have like, I'm doing some marketing right now. We can do, I mean, most of, if you look at Glibba, PNBA, all this stuff, they all offer a marketing deal of like a grand to market across all of their regional platforms. If we can do something like that for marketing, I mean, I don't think there's anything that's stopping us from thinking all together through our trade organizations, how we can solve these problems. Honestly, if we all just try to actually work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe that's optimistic of me, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and thanks for the suggestion about the concept of what trade associations can do. So there is one last question. And crazy enough, we're kind of getting closer to the end of time here, but it's a really important one. So the final one that y'all researched was, what needs to be done to make book printing truly carbon neutral by 2050? So something that when I was reading the report, I was surprised and disappointed by is that paper production's terrible for the environment.
It's
one of the heaviest users of fresh water, the second largest emitter of gases in production. I was just like, oh my gosh, like we're destroying the world. And yet we're creating these books that are trying to sometimes change the world, make it a better place. So, you know, you mentioned, Rachel about like, one of y'all about post-consumer waste paper.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask like, why are more printers not moving toward this? What's stopping them?
Now this is my turn to sound like a broken record. Infrastructure. So a lot of our presses just literally don't have the equipment to do this. Part of it is that. Part of it's also our actual infrastructure overall for recycling, right? The U.S. has a terrible infrastructure for recycling. And so it can make it hard to source paper overall, right? But then one of the biggest contributors to why we can't pulp already existing books that aren't selling is because of the binding and the ink. So it can be more cost, it can be not as cost effective, I should say. If the ink, for instance, is a certain types of ink, it can actually cost more to bleach the paper than it can to actually just, you know, reprint a whole book sometimes. But so it really comes down to the choice of materials that publishers are already using, making it not workable for their current equipment. versus if they upgraded their equipment, they might have more options. But currently, right now, that's where we're at least within the US. There are more printers in Canada who are able to do this.
And is that on the printer then? They need to update their equipment, or is there something like indie publishers can do to, like, I don't know, help or encourage them to do this?
Oh, yes. Indie publishers can, one, always ask for these options. So it's kind of the basic principle with printing with 100% PCW paper or any PCW paper is that right now printers think it's too expensive to use, right? And therefore the cost is very high. But if there is more demand, like we've always seen, right, that levy of the cost will go down if there's more demand. So one, if independent publishers choose to only print with PCW paper and more of them choose to do so, then that's one thing that they can do. And they can also start small. They don't have to go to 100% PCW paper, right? They can go 25, 50, 75, 100, right? And this is also the importance of working, I think Patagonia does this, but instead of working with necessarily always a printer who then works with a paper broker, they work directly with the paper broker. They cut out the middleman and be like, hey, here's what we actually want. Can you give this to us? And then they take their paper and they go print with the public, with the printer. Hmm. So there's different workarounds for it overall, but basically the gist is more demand equals lower prices equals more affordable and more options to be found overall.
And you were talking about other things other than the paper that are also toxic. So there's the ink, the glue. Like, do these eco-friendly options exist, or they're still trying to create them?
You know, honestly, the binding was hard for me to find information about, so I can't answer about binding, but I'm sure that there is, because I know at least with Patagonia and their publisher that they work with, they can do that with. But inks wise, there is actually no completely 100% environmentally safe ink. There are, soy is probably one of the most friendly options. It's what you see a lot of kids' books printed with at these days. And as we know with kids, they eat them a lot of the time. They eat these books. So you'd want your kid, at least that's what my kid does. She tries to eat books all the time. So soy is the best option currently in the market, though there is potential research with algae inks and even UV inks and so on. But it really comes down to, and this is what carbon neutral is, it's like what we're taking from the environment, are we actually putting it back in, right? And if what we're putting back in, is it harmful or is it not harmful? And to what degrees? So it's always like a balancing question.
I think we just like happened upon something that's awesome. I want edible books. Okay, I want to read a book and then I want to eat it for dinner afterwards. So let's get on that.
That would be great. My daughter tries to do that all the time.
Imagine a book of chocolate or cheese or something. That'd be great.
I know. Look, we all did it together. We came up with it together. We'll split it three ways. It'll be great. Okay. So the report has so much in it. And we do not have time to go through all of it. I'm going to include a link on the YouTube link and then on the podcast one. So don't worry. It's on the IBPA website as well. Real quick, I know y'all are working on some things. So Dr. Norda, you're actually going to have a webinar that's going to be co-hosted by IBPA and PubWest. And it's going to be on June 22nd. And it's actually going to be about the report, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So if people want more information about this specifically, yeah, come to that.
Yeah. And then you also did mention that you are working on a part two of the immersive media report. And like you said, we did an episode. You're like a frequent guest. You're like super cool. It's episode 66. It's called Get the Scoop on Book Consumer Buying Habits for Helpful Marketing Insights. So check that one out. And that report, the new one's going to come out sometime coming up, right?
Yep.
Okay, great.
Next few weeks, yeah.
Oh, great. And Rachel, you're, like you said, working on research, looking at barriers, what barriers exist for people with disabilities working in publishing, as well as opportunities or disadvantages that COVID brought to disabled publishing employees. So you're working on that right now. Is that also, what's the...
So I actually just pulled in all of my research. The surveys have closed and all that stuff. And the information that I found is both what I expected to find in both good ways and bad ways. But basically, overall, what I would say the conclusion of the study is hybrid work schedules, flexibility, and allowing people to be remote if needed, and the decentralization of the publishing industry. Not everyone can afford to live in New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or London. We really need to embrace the fact that we are a part of a large ecosystem across the whole entire world. And it's just antiquated that we are focused on one spot only when our jobs are very flexible, as we've seen over the last 2 years. So it's essentially a combination of those things. And that the sad truth is that over, I think, a third of the people that entered my survey, they left jobs because they weren't accommodated by their disabilities. And over two thirds of them wouldn't tell their publisher, their employers, that they were disabled because they were afraid of either stigmatization or that they wouldn't be promoted in the future if they let them know that they were disabled. So that's the gist of it. But more of that information will be available in my paper that will probably, I think it's coming out at the end of June after I graduate.
I mean, that's disappointing and heartbreaking. That makes me upset. So thank you for doing that research, because at least it's kind of getting the word out there about it. And as Rachel, you just mentioned, you will be graduating. I'm assuming by the time this airs, you'll have a job. But if not, you're clearly a genius, so you should hire Rachel, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So everyone listening, we also want you to become a member of IBPA. We, as I said, we helped sponsor this, and we're all about making things successful for indie publishers. If you want to be a member, go to our website, which is ibpa-online.org. And also make sure to subscribe to this podcast. The new episodes drop the last Thursday of every month. Dr. Norder, Rachel, I can't tell you how much we appreciate it. I know how much hard work went into this. And when I read the report, I was like, oh, I'd learned so much. And some things I thought going into it, I was like, oh, okay. I did not know that. And like how terrible, printing production is and all that for the environment. So I just can't tell you how much we appreciate you for taking all this time to create the report.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So thanks again. And thank you everyone for listening, and check back in next month. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.